Good morning. Everybody got quiet. Must be time to start, right? There you go. All right. I guess, by the way, too, if you need to have a picture taken for the friends and family board out there, or you'd like an updated picture, Kendra takes those pictures and takes care of that, so talk to her later. And
be careful.
That's right. The age of miracles is over, Gemma. All right. Yeah, all proceeds from pictures goes to the preacher's retirement fund, so be up front about that. All right, Colossians chapter 3. Still there, yep, still there. Colossians chapter 3. Philippians, Colossians. We're in the midst, right near the end of chapter 3 here, where Paul is dealing with the relationship between slaves and masters in that culture. And we're learning some things. We're right in the section where Paul has his words there for those Christians who have become slaves. And most likely in this time frame, it was people who had perhaps sold themselves into service to make their way in the world. And that was common in those days. Likely we're not talking here about someone who was kidnapped somewhere on foreign soil and forced into this. In many cases, in the first century, these were people who, like an indentured servant, we might say. Anyway, as Paul has been talking to husbands and wives and to parents and children, there's a way that those who have put on Christ are to act in those situations. And God's, of course, instructions in those ways is the best way to work that out. So here he's saying some things to slaves. Let's just back up to verse 22. I think we left off in verse 24, so we'll build up to that. But just so we have the whole context, Colossians 3, 22 says, "Slaves, in all things obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service as those who merely please men, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord." So the idea there is, again, put your heart into it. Because really the one we're serving is God, not someone else. "Whatever you do," verse 23, "do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing," verse 24, "that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve." So the call here for slaves to act in godly ways toward their masters, even the harsh ones, is admittedly a difficult one. We're not saying it's anything other than that. This would certainly be hard to do. Give your best, maybe when you're being mistreated. That's not something anybody looks forward to. But, so, we're not saying it's not hard. Doing the right thing here may not bring any earthly rewards. Okay? But Paul reminds these slaves that if they view their service as ultimately serving the Lord, they can know that they will eventually be amply rewarded for their efforts because he promises an inheritance to those who serve him faithfully, right? So that's kind of the bottom line here, this idea of, if you serve as if you're serving the Lord, he's the one that controls our spiritual inheritance. That's, of course, protected. You may remember back in chapter 2 of this same letter, back in chapter 2 when we talked about that, and that was right in the midst of Paul dealing with the threats to the church there from outsiders who were trying to add something to Christ in this mix. In Colossians 2:18, there Paul said, "Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize," or reward if you will, "by delighting in self-abasement and the worship of angels, taking a stand on visions he has seen, inflated without cause by his fleshly mind." So there, of course, the threat was to be defrauded of that reward. Here, it's on the other side of the equation in chapter 3, verse 24. The Lord knows those who are his. And even those in difficult situations, if they strive to do what God has called them to do, God has a reward, an inheritance, as it's described here. As I was working through this verse, I thought about the example of Ruth. Ruth was in an admittedly difficult situation in the Old Testament, wasn't she? Her husband had died, and she had been taken to a foreign land. She went with her mother-in-law, Ruth. But notice what Boaz says to her. Boaz eventually became her husband, and of course, that ultimately led to King David. But in Ruth 2, verses 11 and 12, it says, Boaz replied to her, speaking of Ruth, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know." So there's a laundry list of things that were difficult for this young foreigner. Notice what Boaz says, verse 12, "May the Lord reward your work." That's what we're talking about, Paul's talking about here. "May the Lord reward your work, and your wages will be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." So there's an example of this principle at work. In Proverbs 18, verse 11, it says, "The wicked earn deceptive wages, but he who sows righteousness gets a true reward." All right? You know, there's rewards, and then there's true rewards, substantial ones. Matthew chapter 5 is part of the Sermon on the Mount. You remember what Jesus said in verses 10 through 12? Jesus says, "Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Again, in the heat of the persecution, in the heat of the struggles of life, it's hard to keep our mind focused on the fact that God will ultimately reward me, even though it doesn't feel like it now. It's probably a problem for us in this nation. You know, we like instant gratification. And I've been trying to find, as I'm thinking through this, Peter, the Apostle Peter, had something to say about just what Jim was describing about, well, this may be what I was thinking of, but it doesn't seem exactly. In 1 Peter 4, verse 12 and following, it says, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though something strange were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of His glory you may rejoice with exultation." Verse 14, "If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or a troublesome meddler a jerk." You could add that to the list. That's right. Verse 15 or 16, "But if anyone suffers as a Christian or for doing things God calls us to do." So, good points. And that, again, Paul is encouraging these slaves who are admittedly in a difficult situation to do what's right, because there is a reward, ultimately. Verse 25 of Colossians 3, he says, "For he who does wrong," and this maybe fit into what we just discussed, "for he who does wrong will receive the consequences of the wrong which he has done, and that without partiality." So in essence here, I see Paul is talking about the flip side of the equation. The flip side of the equation is that those who choose to ignore the call to godly behavior and relationships will face the consequences of that choice with no exceptions. We can't presume that as a child of God, we are exempt or that we get a pass from the fallout disregarding God's standards in the way we act in our marriages, in the way we act in our families, or in the way we act in our employment, for the three examples Paul uses. And we like justice to come down to us, but it's hard to let it flow down to wherever we're on that ladder. Good point. And again, think here in context of this slave. You know, it's possible this Christian slave is being treated unjustly, and how that would be hard to bear up under and to do the right thing. You know, it's easy to do the right thing when it's easy. But it's sure hard to do it when it does seem unfair or it is really unjust. This idea, it says, for he who does wrong will receive the consequences of the wrong which he has done, and that without partiality. Of course, the Bible over and over again affirms that God is an impartial judge. How thankful we can be for that. Romans 2:11 says there is no partiality with God. So, you know, Christian or not, we stand before someone who's called us to a standard, and we will, you know, God will, you know, sin brings punishment, consequences, and we might like it to be otherwise, but that's not the way it works. So, all right, let's move into chapter 4. Sure, you bet. How often as parents do we hear, it's not fair. It's not fair. And, you know, there's a sense here, you know, maybe these slaves would have been, you know, humanly justified. But God, it's not fair. Why should I have to do the right thing here? You paid them the same as you paid. And, of course, that's the whole point of that parable, isn't it? That's Matthew 20, I think. You want to read? Yeah. Justly. That's what the landowner said. Yeah. I paid you what I said I would. Yeah. All right. So, and again, I do want to emphasize here, you know, this is in no way, because these verses were used centuries ago by people who justified the kind of slavery that was done early in this country. Well, look, the Bible says this. That's misusing this text as well, because you get places here, and we'll talk about it here when we get to Master. Let's move into chapter 4. God was pretty clear in the old law about, for sure, about taking care. You know, you don't kidnap people. You don't force these type of things. But let's talk about the masters. He spent some time talking about the slaves. Verse 4, or chapter 4, verse 1, Paul says, "Masters, grant to your slaves justice." There's that word. "Justice and fairness, knowing that you too have a master in heaven." That keeps coming back, doesn't it? There's a master out there that husbands and wives and children and fathers and slaves and masters are beholding to. As has been true in the earlier examples, Paul has godly instructions here for both sides of the slave-master relationship. The culture around them may have given masters a great deal of latitude in the treatment or mistreatment, as it may be, of slaves. That's, you know, the first century. You know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, if you were a slave, the masters pretty much had free rein to treat you however they wanted. Anyway, regardless of the fact that the culture may have given masters that leeway, that was not the way it was to be with a Christian master. Here's a couple of places I had from the Old Covenant rules of God. Leviticus 19, verse 13, God, through Moses, said, "You shall not oppress your neighbor, nor rob him. The wages of a hired man are not to remain with you all night until morning." So there were, you know, this employee-employer relationship, master-slave, there were guidelines, rules for that. Later in Leviticus chapter 25, verses 39 through 43, says, "If a countryman of yours becomes poor, so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you," and again, likely that's probably the primary thing Paul has in mind here in the first century. "Anyway, if a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, you shall not subject him to a slave service." So there was a difference. "He shall be with you as a hired man, as if he were a sojourner. He shall serve with you until the year of Jubilee. Then he shall go out from you, he and his sons with him, and shall go back to his family, and he may return to the property of his forefathers. For they are my servants whom I have brought out of the land of Egypt. They are not to be sold in a slave sale. You shall not rule over him with severity, but are to revere your God. Of course, here again, it's Jew dealing with Jew. And so, you know, we could maybe broaden that somewhat, but you get a sense of God's heart here. You know, God, in some sense, conceded to the culture in which he was trying to form a nation. And the slave master thing was part of that. Deuteronomy 15 has a section as well about Deuteronomy 15, 12 through 15. Again, treatment of servants and slaves. So the whole idea here, though, verse 1, he's reminding the masters as he reminded the slaves that you have a master in heaven, that's God. A master should treat his slaves with justice and fairness because he understands that he too has a master and desires to be treated with justice and fairness. We could just remember that principle. You know, if the Bible would have just said somewhere about treating others as we'd like to be treated, you know, it'd be simpler, wouldn't it? Yeah, that principle's there. So, again, these situations, whatever the relationship is, if both sides are endeavoring to deal with each other in a godly way, then that's the best situation. Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. We won't get to it yet for a little while in chapter 4 here, but it's likely Colossae is where Philemon lived. We've got the letter to Philemon, and Onesimus was his slave and had apparently run away and found Paul in Rome. Paul converted him, and then Paul writes this letter. It's like some read this week said maybe the letter to Colossae and the letter to Onesimus was delivered the same time. So, you know, this was a very real situation in Colossae because you've got a slave owner, Philemon, and of course the book of Philemon, Paul writes that to that slave owner and instructs him about receiving Onesimus back in the right way. So, we may talk about that at the end of this. We'll see if we get to that. But, all right. That pretty well covers these three specific examples that Paul uses. Husbands, wives, children, fathers, slaves, masters. Beginning in verse 2 of chapter 4, Paul moves from specific relationships to general instructions for all believers. So he broadens the scope a little bit here. And you might say, well, I don't have any of those three, so I'm off the hook. Well, here's some general things that we're all called to do. Verse 2 says, devote yourselves to prayer. And these things would certainly fit in those other relationships, but devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving. Devoting yourselves to prayer. Your version might say things like continue earnestly, continue steadfastly. It's just the idea of being constant in it. To withstand the threats from the false teachers in Colossae and to endeavor to put off the old self and put on the new self, things we've just, Paul's just written about, and we could add to the last, in order to deal with each other in our relationships in godly ways, would require a strength that only God provides. You know, when you think about what Paul is calling us to do, we really don't have the resources we need on our own to handle that. And, you know, you just got to look around the world, look around us, or probably in our own lives to see how hard it is to carry it out. Anyway, we need God's strength. So Paul here encourages these believers to be committed to communicating with the one who can strengthen them for that process. Devote yourselves to prayer with thanksgiving. Yeah. I don't believe so either, for sure. Paul's talked about prayer a lot in this book so far. In fact, way back in chapter 1, verse 9, when he's talking about, he's praising them in those early verses for so many good things. This was a good church in a lot of ways. Paul says, "For this reason also, since the day we heard of it, we have not ceased to pray for you and to ask that you be filled with the knowledge of His will and all spiritual wisdom and understanding." So Paul says, my mission team and I have been praying, been devoting ourselves in prayer to you and to no doubt all the other churches in Asia there. Here, when we get toward the end of chapter 4, verse 12, Paul says, this Epaphras, who is one of your number, a bond slave of Jesus Christ, sends you his greetings, always laboring earnestly for you in his prayers, that you may stand perfect and fully assured in all the will of God. So, the Colossian church has people praying for them. Paul says, I want to encourage you to devote yourselves to prayer for yourself, for others, admittedly in a difficult situation. Again, in context, their faith was being threatened. They've been called to do some difficult things. The prayer shouldn't be the last resort for this group of believers, right? Might be the first thing. It's the first thing Paul brings up here in a general way. Jesus said in Luke 18, verse 1, he tells a parable about... Now he says, now he was telling them a parable to show that they at all times ought to pray and not lose heart. Those things are tied together there, right? A lack of prayer might tend to lead us toward losing heart in a matter. It's all communication with the power source. Keeping alert in it, he says. Devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it. A lack of diligence in prayer can often be a result of becoming inattentive to the spiritual dangers around us, right? The old King James says, be vigilant in it. Or be watchful, NIV or ESV says. So, a devotion to prayer includes a realization on our part that if we're keeping alert in it, you know, we're aware of our surroundings. Again, don't, over and over again in the scriptures, we're encouraged to do this, and why is it? Why would Jesus and the apostles be so insistent to the Christians about telling them to be alert? Any reason you can think of? Yeah, 1 Peter 5:8, be of sober spirit. That's the same thing as be alert. Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. All right. The enemy, he's always at work. The enemy is devoted to destroying us. So we need to be devoted to prayer and keep alert in it to ward that off. And we can get lulled to sleep in life. Distracted, yeah. Squirrel. Yeah. Let's talk about this right near the end of the verse where it says, with an attitude of thanksgiving. And Jim highlighted that just a minute ago. Being devoted to and being alert in prayer comes easier, I believe, when we reflect on everything for which we should be grateful to God. I think they go hand in hand with all of that. Back in chapter 2 of this letter, Colossians 2 verse 7, Paul says, having been firmly rooted and now being built up in Him and established in your faith, just as you were instructed, and overflowing with gratitude. Okay? I love that description, overflowing with gratitude. Maybe you can think of someone in your life that you would categorize this way. There's probably fewer of them than the ones like the rest of us. But someone who always finds that way to be grateful, even in a bad situation. If only the good habits were as easy to develop as the bad ones. You know. That's just like over and over again, be not afraid. Well, that kind of implies that it's much easier to be fearful. So, and there are, even the doctors and the scientists can quantify some of that, that you have a better chance of overcoming some of these serious diseases just by virtue of the attitude you take toward it. Not that that always works, but because, you know, some of the happiest and most optimistic people have died from a disease, but it helps in most cases. So remind you of a few other verses here. I guess our time's about up, but Philippians 4:6 is probably more well known than Colossians 4:2, but Paul says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God." Ephesians 5:4, "And there must be no filthiness or silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks." So that kind of pits the two against the other. You know, it's far easier probably for most of us to dive into the other side of those things rather than the giving of thanks. But and believe me, I'm speaking from the side of someone who needs to learn this. You know, I've always kind of been, we joke in my family, I'm the Eeyore of the tale. I can find a dark cloud in every silver lining. So I work at that. So anyway, final thoughts. We'll stop there for today, but if you didn't get a chance to say something. All right. Pick up your study this week in verse 3 of chapter 4, and Lord willing, we'll pick that up next week.